on the court's docket is State versus Christopher Armand Peters, 82437. Mr. Hill, you ready to go?
Yes, sir. And good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Dan Hill. I represent Christopher Peters in this matter. And if I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
I don't believe a reply brief was filed in this case, so.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I don't believe a reply brief was filed case, so you'll have to consume all of your time direct appeal.
With the court's permission, I'll start with the public trial element of this appeal. It's one that both sides agree is subject to the structural error analysis. I'll start with the state's main case in opposition or answer to the brief, which was Weaver versus Massachusetts. And there's a couple of key distinctions I wanted to emphasize with the court. One is the scope of the public trial violation in Weaver versus Massachusetts. There, at issue with the court, at issue with the trial was two family members who were excluded during a portion of the trial. Specifically, it was two family members excluded during the jury selection process. They weren't excluded from the trial process, and there wasn't any kind of blanket exclusion. A marshal there made a decision to exclude two people during the jury selection process. The second difficulty in applying the Weaver v. Mass analysis to this case, because it was in the context of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, or there was a dual layer of analysis that involved Strickland. And so the burden on the defense there was an element of would the outcome have been different, which shifted slightly from a straight structural error analysis. And we're also looking at would the outcome of the trial have been different because it was subsumed in another layer of analysis under Strickland. So the difference here is this is raised in a straight structural error context on direct appeal rather than a collateral attack. What they looked at in Weaver versus Massachusetts was, and it was a disjunctive, did it render the trial unfair? That's kind of how they analyzed it under Strickland. Did it render the trial unfair such that the outcome would have been different? That's how they were analyzing it under Strickland. Or did it pervade the whole trial? That's the language in Weaver versus Mass. We're looking at, did it pervade the whole trial, or did it render the trial unfair? Here, of course, there's a key difference, and that is, notwithstanding the streaming, which I'll address in a moment, it was a blanket exclusion from the entire trial process or the entire public in terms no individual was allowed to be physically present in the court other than the parties and the witnesses.
Well, the record said there was a limited number, and that then there would be streaming. Which piece are you talking about?
I'm talking about the trial proper. During jury selection, which was in a different courtroom, there was two seats. And with the streaming during jury selection, which goes along with my concerns with the streaming, during jury selection, the record reflects that the cameras were only pointed at the parties and the court. So there was no panning or switching of the streaming during jury selection. So there were two chairs off to the side in the jury selection. So the complete and total exclusion occurred during the reception of evidence in the trial proper. During jury selection, there was two seats and the cameras were only focused on the court and the parties, the state and the defense.
But why should we consider it to be closure if the trial was live streamed? I think in Chaparro, which we dealt with last year and dealt with virtual appearances during the pandemic, and I think it was a sentencing hearing in particular, and this was Justice Stiglitz's case, one of the things we said was fairness and justice of the proceedings cannot be divorced from the circumstances under which the proceedings take place.
I think there's a, in other words, why was the streaming inadequate?
Yeah.
I think one difference from that case and this is just the nature of the proceedings. I mean, the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial attached to the reception of evidence in a contested trial specifically. When it comes to the streaming, I outline in my brief one concern, which is as the JAV system works, every few minutes it changes its focus on someone else. So in other words, that the state would have that audio, functionally what's that saying is audio only is sufficient. Because there was plenty of time during that trial where something was being said, a lot of time during that trial where something was being said that wasn't necessarily on the screen.
Well, the sound was on the screen, but the person wasn't on the screen.
Correct.
So like everyone sitting behind you right now can't see your face.
Right.
But they can hear your words.
Right.
Are we having a public, I mean, is this a public proceeding? Are we violating someone's rights by not having that perspective?
No, Your Honor, because I think when you look at it, both in this context here and in a trial context, there's more than just the person speaking. So, for example, I'll dial back to say, I believe that the state's position is the same as saying audio only is sufficient for a public trial. The streaming basically says if a lawyer is talking, a public trial does not allow the public to observe the jury's reaction, the judge's reaction, the defendant's reaction. In other words, the state's position, but you can hear what's going on, but the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial doesn't go any further than that. Which could mean with the production of daily transcripts at the close of business for review of what was said. With that, I think I'm going to go a step further and say the state, they're making that argument as well. If the only thing that matters in the context of a public trial is what's being said, then the production of daily transcripts at close of business, available if the public came down to the clerk's office and filled out a piece of paper and said, I want the dailies from trial today, the state's argument would say that that is sufficient because it would allow the members of the public to ascertain what was spoken in court. But certainly the Sixth Amendment concerns of a public trial are concerned with a lot more than that. They're concerned with, assuring the fairness of the proceedings. There's concomitant First Amendment concerns with the press.
So how would the proceeding be unfair if someone in the audience or the viewing audience can't see the expression on one particular juror's face while they're taking evidence?
Well, I think first and foremost, if we're using Weaver versus Massachusetts, it's not incumbent upon the defendant to show unfairness where the closure permeates the entire proceeding.
Well, we have a courthouse in Nevada where the jurors sit in the front and their backs are to the audience. The audience sits actually behind the jury and the jury sits in the central space. So does that configuration in and of itself violate the right to a public trial?
I don't think so because you can still perceive A, their demeanor, but B, specific. I mean, if a juror is falling asleep or if a juror is, reading the newspaper, there's aspects of concern with juror participation in a trial that could be assuaged.
Would it be fair to say that a lot of the concerns here with the public nature of the trial were as a result of of COVID at the time and COVID restrictions and recommendations from the CDC?
Because
it was 100%, right?
What the analysis goes is whether or not, I'll borrow language from a strict scrutiny review. If we look at a narrow tailor, certainly I appreciate the fact that both members of this court and the district court worked assiduously in a short period of time to try, in light of the pandemic, to bring trials back so that defendants could have their day in court. Having now hindsight is 2020, of course. So my day job is a trial lawyer. And so obviously the court is well aware that public access to a trial from the get-go is kind of a legal fiction. People are not beating down the doors to come to these trials unless it's, I did the Bundy case. That one was full every day. your run-of-the-mill trial, there's nobody in the courtroom by and large. So from the get-go, we're looking at a bit of a legal fiction that anybody comes to these trials anyway. That's never entered into the analysis.
But from the get-go, then, isn't streaming, I mean, as I thought I understood, and correct me, there were some seats, limited, albeit, there were some seats. Doesn't streaming actually make the trial more accessible to the public, get more people an opportunity to see the trial, coupled with not a complete bar to people actually coming into the courtroom?
So I'll just emphasize again, there was two seats during jury selection, zero seats during the trial itself, the reception of evidence. And the position that we're in is those policy considerations of whether or not anyone actually goes to the trials is nowhere to be found in the Supreme Court's analysis. And the reason I bring it up is we were in courtroom 3F, which, as the court is aware, is a very large courtroom. It's very spaced out. Given that the demands of public access to a more quotidian trial versus one of the large scale ones, the demand is not exceedingly high. Having chairs available 6 feet apart and in compliance with the COVID requirements set forth would have ameliorated the technical concerns of that Sixth Amendment analysis, which is public access. Again, two or three chairs would have allowed the public to access physically the courtroom in a capacity that would match the demand for a trial like this.
But your approach is kind of creating an inflexible rule. I tried a mesothelioma civil case in which we had to remove all the public seating from the courtroom to fit in all the attorneys and the parties. So we live streamed to the courtroom next door. Not every court can accommodate members of the public if you're accommodating family members and the press, depending on the nature of the case, right? You kind of got to do what you can do. And isn't court closure really about limiting the access of people to have any understanding of what's going on in a trial, in a court proceeding? Not that they have some quasi-right of confrontation to sit in the courtroom and be able to watch people.
I don't know if the streaming was any more sophisticated in your honor's trial than it was mine. I don't think it's about providing some understanding. It has to be more, otherwise the analysis would so reflect, it has to be more than merely ascertaining what was spoken in court. Now, certainly that's not to say that there was no streaming, that there was no visuals whatsoever. In this case, but it was limited. There's a limited number of cameras, and what's observed is limited.
Mr. Hill, if I could, did you finish your response to?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I want, because you didn't have a reply time, I wanted to cover something that I want to cover with counsel. I appreciate all that you're saying, and having represented a lot of newspapers for a lot of my career, I appreciate the public trial right, not just on behalf of the defendant, the state, but also on behalf of the news media. But in this instance, one of the things that occurred was an explanation by the trial judge of what was going to happen here in advance. And what I'm concerned about is why we aren't analyzing this case under Jeremiah. Was this a forfeited error? In which case, it would make the analysis quite a bit different. The parties don't appear to have briefed that, but it seems to me that when we're talking about, and you characterize it as a structural error, I'm not sure it's structural, but it certainly is one that may affect the defendant's substantial rights, but it does appear to be a forfeited error. Why isn't that the case? And why shouldn't we be examining this case under Jeremiah versus State?
My understanding, Your Honor, was we were advised that that was the court's planned.
Forgive me for interrupting, but just to add, my understanding is that you and the defendant were informed. Defendant consented to this approach.
My understanding was that the defendant agreed to proceed with trial, having been told of this approach. I don't think necessarily at central trial readiness I ever would have conceded that they were non-objectionable I certainly would have advised my client my intent to object. I think the court can glean from the record that Mr. Peters was very eager to go to trial. He invoked, and I think he was still, my read and the reason why I would pitch that it doesn't apply, Your Honor, would be we were advised. Mr. Peters was asked, in light of this is how the court's going to approach it, do you still want to proceed with trial? Didn't necessarily waive an objection to those procedures, but said, yeah, I still want to go to trial in light of those procedures. The footnote being, and I understand that my attorney is going to object.
I see. Okay, we'll go back and look at that transcript.
Very good, Your Honor. Thank you.
Did you have any, I think that concluded your time. Were there any other questions for Mr. Hill?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Mr. Montes.
Good morning. My name is Chad Alexis. This is Morgan Thomas. We are the prosecutors on this case. Defense counsel, first I'll start with what you just stated, Your Honor, with regards to a calendar call is when he was advised by the court on how proceedings were going to be, how where the jury selection was going to be, and how everyone was going to be wearing masks, in which him and the defendant agreed to proceed with trial. Now, it wasn't until Your Honor spoke with regards to COVID before defense counsel even mentioned it. And that was the underlying reason for both of this. As far as the courtroom setup, it was tailored to COVID protocols, and there was no extra seats in that courtroom. In addition, defense counsel spent most of his time on the live stream. Well, in Waller v. Georgia, the U.S. Supreme Court, the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial is not absolute and must give way in some cases to other interests essential to the fair administration of justice. Follow that up with the Ninth Circuit in U.S. v. Hernandez, which says the right to a public trial has always been interpreted as being subject to a trial court's power to keep order in the courtroom. And in my perspective, in the state's perspective, when a trial court's order to the courtroom and a fair administration of justice, I believe at the top of the list would be the health and safety of the people in the courtroom and for those jurors to focus on the actual trial, which obviously wouldn't be the case. This is months after the pandemic, we're being shut down. The process had to be keeping moving. We didn't have jurors that wanted to come in because they were scared of COVID. So obviously Justice Pickering and together with the district court came up with the order that mandated all masks that need to be worn in the courtroom. And that's what was followed. So I absolutely believe that the court, pursuant to the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court, had the authority to give way to live stream, especially in the manner in which it did. And it wasn't just COVID either. If you think about, I'm sure the Supreme Court justices saw it and the district court judges saw it, but in justice court, it was a nightmare down there. It was, the wheels weren't turning. People were getting released. Court cases were getting pushed. Only the most severe people were being kept in custody. And even then, trials weren't happening. So something had to be done. And obviously, Justice Pickering acted with the order through this court. And then trials were essentially being done. With regards to the other part of his appeal, with regards to the mask and the defendant removing the mask, that is something done that we were talking to the judge about prior to the identification of the defendant. And obviously, it would have been completely, you know, not reliable if we would have had the defendant take the mask off first, if the judge say, okay, well, it's time to identify the witness and have to take the mask down. No. So in order to ensure reliability, it was us, particularly me, the state, before the trial was going on, to push the judge for the defendant's benefit to, after an identification was made, if it was made, to then have him take his mask off to then assure that that person was the person they were identifying.
So that procedure was discussed before that happened in open court?
Yes, ma'am.
And did the defendant object to that procedure?
No. Let me put it this way. We were talking about that. At calendar call, that wasn't objected to. I do believe the defense counsel did make an overall objection to the mask in general when the trial began.
and certainly objected when the questions were asked. But I'm curious about what occurred. It sounded from what you were saying, there was a conversation before the witness got up and this colloquy happened.
On how the procedure was going to happen, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Which leads to my question, Mr. Alexis. Why aren't we evaluating this case under Jeremiah? Why isn't this a case of forfeited error?
Well, sir,
I mean, when the defendant and or counsel hear the process that the judge is going to use and agrees to it, even if that process might otherwise be questionable, I'll just characterize it that way, as violating a public trial right. Why isn't that a forfeited error, in which case we would evaluate the forfeited error under Jeremiah?
Well, I definitely could see that route, Your Honor, especially given, again, a calendar call, how all the procedures were falling over.
Yeah.
And none of that was made a calendar call.
Could you clear, you appear to have the transcript there, maybe you don't, but did the defendant, I understood the defendant to acknowledge this process when it was being discussed. Did the defendant or counsel acknowledge the process and agree to that? And Judge, if not, we can go check it if you don't have it. That's okay.
I don't have the exact
that's okay.
transcript on me, but I have the minutes from the court.
Well, I'd rather check the transcript. That's fine. We'll look at the transcript. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Alexis.
Now, another portion, first of all, too, I want to bring up that since these briefs were filed, this court has addressed in an order of affirmance in Belcher v. State a situation where the defendant claimed his rights were violated because him and his counsel had to wear masks. And this court said such a requirement fits well within the public policy exception for face-to-face meetings because masks further the public policy interests in ensuring the health and safety of everyone. And you also cited to the case in our brief, which was Maryland v. Craig, which says basically the confrontation of a trial must occasionally give way to considerations of public policy. And the Ohio v. Roberts, U.S. Supreme Court, they stated that that's not an absolute right. And so in Maryland v. Craig, you're looking at two things. Was the denial of such confrontation necessary to further an important public policy? We weren't asking much. You weren't asking much. Justice Pickering wasn't asking much. When we're talking about a pandemic, health and safety, cover your mask, cover your face. Defense counsel comes back at, oh, well, you know, you could have wore a plastic shield. Well, as we attach the CDC guidelines, it clearly states a plastic shield at that time was not acceptable. And defense counsel also states that, you know, we could have done more of the social distancing. Well, once again, the CDC guidelines say regardless of social distancing at that time, you were to wear a mask. So once we accomplish that first prong, you go to the prong two, which was the reliability under Craig. Well, what does the court say of reliability under Craig? Was the witness present? Was there testimony under oath? Were they subject to cross-examination? And were they able to observe the demeanor? And I would absolutely, one, two, and three were met. And as far as demeanor, we cite numerous cases upholding the demeanor element of this. We're talking about the nose and the mouth. What are you going to get from a nose? Not much. As far as the mouth, what's the most important thing with regards to being present and observing somebody as far as the mouth? Well, the fluctuation of the voice. Are they stuttering? Are they shimmering? The body language was able to be observed. The eyes were being observed. How they were positioning themselves, their hands, so forth, were all able to be observed. So I absolutely believe that the Craig requirements were met with regards to it didn't go farther than necessary to ensure the public policy exception consideration in this case and the reliability. There was also an appellate case out of Minnesota after the briefs were filed in this case. And that case was pretty much similar to the order that Justice Pickering had. Their Supreme Court justice issued an order and required masks, and that court also cited the trade factors. And also there was a objection to the live feed, and they had the same type of reasoning as I previously went over with regards to U.S. v. Hernandez, in which the trial judge has power to keep order in the courtroom, citing public health and safety policies with COVID, and paying attention to the trial. With regards to...
Was the site of the case?
Oh, yes. That was...
Did you file any supplemental authorities, Mr. Alexis?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Would you please do so in a formal pleading so that Mr. Hill has a copy of it?
Regarding the cases that
you signed? Ma'am. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was Court of Appeals in Minnesota State versus Motlin, M-O-D-T-L-A-N-D, 970 Northwest 2nd, 7-11.
7 what?
7-11?
Yes, 7-11.
7-1-1. In regards to harmless error, Your Honor, there's video in this case. The evidence was overwhelming. The person that was working there came into the court and personally saw that this individual come in and steal these items. She is one of the people that identified him in court. He's then caught minutes later at a tire establishment right across the street, basically. The cops call him, caught him. He had the stolen merchandise in his hand, as well as the stolen credit cards and other items of personal possession in his property, of which those other, the two of the owners of that stolen property came in and testified that this individual had, was not entitled to any of that stuff. Shouldn't be in a possession of it. That I don't have anything
to do. Counsel, just, may I? Mm-hmm. Just because we have a couple minutes left, absent COVID type situation, you agree a court, it probably wouldn't pass muster for a court to just say, even though we have seats, we're just going to stream it. So, do you agree with that proposition?
Yes.
And with respect to the masks and the unmasking piece, can you just address, because it's addressed in the briefing, whether you thought the way in which that proceeded was unduly suggestive or not, and why not?
Say that one more time.
The way the court asked after that, on its own, was, I understand, its own motion to have the defendant pull down his mask. Anything you wanted to say about that procedure?
We would have never got to that procedure if they didn't identify. The understanding was, if the witness was on the stand and didn't identify, wasn't able to identify anybody, I wasn't then going to say, okay, judge, you now have the defendant take down his mask, so then, and then ask the witness, said, now can you identify? I agree, that would be unduly suggestive, since he'd be the only person in the courtroom without a mask on, and we still don't have an identification. But how he did it, I think, is just to the defendant's benefit. We waited until after there was a positive identification, which three of the five witnesses positively identified him without touching any mask, and then he had him taken down.
Because there were witnesses who did not identify him, and therefore he was never asked to pull his mask down, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And those were the two that were had the stolen personal identifying information and the credit cards, which obviously we
sure. And so was it the judges? Did the judge sua sponte decide to ask the defendant to pull down the mask? Because that's how it's been framed, as opposed to, again, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to pin it down. Before the questioning of the witnesses, that was decided or suggested on how to proceed.
That was decided before we started.
Okay. The trial. Okay. Thanks.
To help me locate that, what is the date of that minute order that you were going to refer to, Mr. Alexis?
That was September 16, 2020. I could give you mine if you want me to vote.
No, that's okay. All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Alexis, Mr. Hill. Thank you for your time. I'm sorry, counsel, your appearance?
Morgan Thomas.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you all. This case will stand submitted.